Oxford Sparks podcast, episode 8, Clues, part 1.
So you can probably get a sense of what it's like to be near an erupting volcano. There are two things that would surprise you. One is that depending on where you are compared to the volcano, eruptions can be completely quiet. Some volcanoes erupt and they're incredibly noisy, and others are really rather quiet because you're tens of kilometres away and there's this enormous boiling, roiling ash cloud rising up into the air. So I'm David Pyle and I'm Professor of Earth Sciences, and my research specialty is volcanology. Now, it's actually quite unusual for volcanoes to erupt without any prior warning. Usually, there'll be signs that you can detect in advance. And they might be signs that only scientists can see because they've got sensitive instruments. Maybe you can see a signal from a satellite instrument that's looking at the shape of the Earth's surface. But usually the real clincher for volcanologists is that if there are instruments put around the volcano to measure the shaking of the Earth during earthquakes, those are usually the instruments that will give you some advance warning of magma moving up through the volcano, breaking rock, and causing these very small earthquakes. And the hope is that, in many volcanoes anyway, those earthquakes won't be very large, but they will often be large enough that people on the ground can feel them within the few hours, weeks, or days prior to an eruption. It's probably fair to say that there are different sorts of volcanoes, different sorts of ways that volcanoes behave. We know that some volcanoes are very noisy. They can have thousands of earthquakes in the lead-up to an eruption, and others are essentially silent, and we don't really know why. One of the most significant advances in volcanology in the last 30 or 40 years has been the development of instruments that people have put on satellites that can now be used for global monitoring. And the first of those instruments that were used were in the late 1970s, and so from the late 1970s we've got a pretty good record of big volcanic eruptions that have released sufficiently large quantities of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. In the last 15 years, the biggest difference are the addition of instruments that are kind of radar instruments. And essentially what happens is that these radar instruments can be used to map the shape of the Earth's surface, and then if you take repeated measurements of the same area, you can very quickly see very small differences at the centimeter scale between these radar images. Starting in 2013, there's a constellation of satellites going up called Sentinel, and those Sentinel satellites have the capacity to essentially to map Earth's entire surface every few days using these radar instruments.
The hope is that these will soon offer real-time monitoring.
The scientific challenge is to move from a case where, you know, an individual scientist might spend their PhD looking at a few images, radar images of a particular volcano to try and reconstruct a time sequence of what's going on, and the challenge is now to move from that sort of enterprise to enterprise where you can use machines to do the raw processing and pick out signals that can then be interpreted by the scientists. Actually, it's a bit too easy for volcanologists to say, well, of course, we have to understand everything about this particular volcano before we can tell you about it, because that's a cop-out. We really should be thinking about how we can translate what we can understand about the 100 or 200 volcanoes that have erupted in the last century and be able to use that learning quickly in the case of an escalation of activity at a volcano that's not yet erupted.
What can we learn from previous eruptions?
I guess as physical scientists, we're kind of used to innovating. You find a new toy to put on a volcano, or you find the instrument you've got is too big and it's too expensive, and you find a way of making it work better and cheaper and faster. And so it's always about, you know, making more measurements better and faster than people have done before. And the trouble with that approach is that people very rarely have the time or the interest in actually looking back to see, well, how well did we do with that previous eruption? How well did the instruments that we had work in terms of helping us understand the volcano? In the project that we're involved in the Caribbean and Latin America, the Striva project, we're working with social scientists and communities who live around volcanoes, and we're much more interested in understanding how communities have adapted to living with an active volcano, or how people responded to previous volcanic eruptions and what we can learn from those responses in order to improve our capacity to plan ahead, think about what might happen in the future. In parts of Europe, that historical record might last for thousands of years in Italy, for example. And in some parts of the world, that historical record of volcanic eruptions might only last for a couple of generations, for a few hundred years at the most. Certainly parts of southern Chile, for example, where there is no written record of what happened during eruptions before the 19th century. So in those cases, we need to go into the field, and we need to physically dig through the soil horizons and in, you know, take samples from lakes and peat bogs, and then try to understand what those deposits are telling us about past eruptions, put it into a time frame, and then try and bridge the gap between the geological record, where, of course, small eruptions leave no trace, and the historical record or contemporary records, where we've got much higher resolution of observation. We can see things happening right now, but of course, geologically, they might be quite small events. So obviously, during an eruption, people can detect ash falling out, even with its, you know, they can see the cars are suddenly coated in a thin film of ash. And in the geological record, we can recognise those deposits once they're more than a few millimetres thick. You know, a little layer of something that's grey or yellow or white or red even. And it usually stands out visually against the background soil or lake sediment or whatever. And increasingly people are actually interested in, you know, if you collect a lake core sample, you can then either look at the sample under a microscope, or you can use a sort of a chemical technique to try and identify the chemical signature of the volcanic ash compared to the normal background sediment. What we've been doing in Chile, where we've been doing this work for the last few years, is collecting the visible horizons where we can identify volcanic ash or pumice, and characterizing that volcanic ash chemically, so using electron beam techniques to give us the chemical composition of tiny, tiny fragments of glass. And the one thing we do know is that each volcanic eruption typically has its own fingerprint. We can define that fingerprint because we've got one deposit that we know is a particular event, and then you can map out the extent of that deposit by comparing the chemical fingerprints of the other samples that you've measured.
If each eruption or volcano has its own fingerprint, what can be learnt from these deposits?
So the deposits tell us about the characteristics of particular eruptions. If we look at the example that we've been working on in St. Vincent in the Caribbean, for example, from the geological remnants of the last few eruptions, they're quite sparse. We know that it can have dramatically explosive eruptions, and the ash thrown out during those eruptions will often be transported across to Barbados, and you can find the deposits in situ in Barbados. We have some, there's obviously some uncertainty about exactly what might happen during the next eruption, but we can say, well, our experience geologically is that the last four eruptions have had these sorts of patterns of behaviour. And so that's a fair starting point if you're going to be talking to the communities about what might happen during a future event. And again, St. Vincent's quite an interesting place to work. There was a huge eruption in 1902, which was really extremely disruptive and very damaging. And so many of the residents of St. Vincent still remember the stories that their grandparents told them about being displaced and having to move house and setting up home in a new place. And that memory has been strengthened because there was about 2 weeks of quite strong volcanic activity in 1979. During the 1979 eruption, there was actually spontaneous evacuation. Again, there was a cultural memory of what had happened 77 years before that. So I think, you know, in some communities, it's clear that the stories of past eruptions get passed down and then become reinvigorated when there's new activity. And so it's actually fascinating on having meetings on St. Vincent, asking people about what they remembered about those past eruptions, and then getting them to use that information to think about what might be different during a future eruption.
David then talked about the Striva project, which looks at strengthening resilience in volcanic areas. First, on the island of Montserrat.
So on Montserrat, the protocols in terms of who makes decisions evolved pretty quickly. And I think from about 1998 onwards, regular meetings of groups of scientists from the observatory with external experts. And those groups have then come to a consensus decision, often by doing a series of standardized tests. So independently, everyone is asked, is it going to erupt? If it erupts, will it be this big or that small? And how sure are you that that will happen rather than something else?
At Tungurahua in Ecuador, the local community has taken a different approach.
At Tungurahua, the Vihirs actually have formed a really important network. They have some intuition about how the volcano behaves based on what they've seen over the last 20 years, that intuition has worked pretty well. I mean, obviously the scientists have also got their own intuition, which is based on measurements, and it's based on the relationship between the signals of the volcano and then what subsequently happens. That relationship seems to have built up organically, but it's been very effective. The tragedy, which we hope won't unfold to Tungurahua, the tragedy at some other volcanoes is that when you have an event during a long-lived eruption, which is suddenly an order of magnitude larger than any previous event that's been seen, then of course everyone's intuition is essentially meaningless. That was certainly the case in Montserrat in the mid-1997, an event that was just much larger and suddenly overwhelmed everybody, and that led to significant fatalities.
What are David's hopes for how volcanologists can help improve warning systems in the future?
Hopes for the future are probably two things. One is that by accumulating much more observational data, which we now have the capacity for with satellites and remote sensing, that really fairly quickly we'll get a much better understanding of the relationship between what happens at a volcano and what happens at a volcano just before it erupts. But that will require putting together the information about the sort of earthquake activity, the seismology at the volcanoes, along with the satellite information. So that's some of the scientific side. Another area where I think we've got huge potential to make significant advances are by listening to the stories of the people who live around volcanoes and who've lived through volcanic eruptions in the past, because that's a voice we never hear. Those records disappear. Often they're oral histories, and scientists have not been attuned to listening for those stories and thinking about how we can use that information to improve our capacity to live through future volcanic eruptions.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Lou Sumner, and produced by Steve Pritchard for the University of Oxford. For more fascinating science, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, or head to oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk.